What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute Productions. I'm your host, Blake Howard. This is a long overdue interview. This happened at the Adelaide Film Festival in last October. I got to chat with Sophie Hyde, Ord Mason Hyde, Daniel Henschel, and Kate Box about Jimper. Writer-director Sophie Hyde was there for the Australian premiere. Ord Mason Hyde, Daniel Henschel, and Kate Box are the stars of the movie, with Ord basically in the leading role. It was a great chat. It's a terrific film. It's reviewed back on One Hot Take, or One Hot Fest, our special version of One Hot Take, a long, long, long time ago. You'll have to go back through the feed. But I've had this interview sitting out until the movie was more broadly circulated, had a theatrical run. And if you didn't get a chance to see it, it's probably going to appear on VOD soon. So what I wanted to do was get this interview out there for you to have a listen to. It's a terrific chat. They're great and hilarious and talented people. The movie is a banger, has one of the best needle drops of last year that nearly snuck it into my top 10. But why don't you guys have a listen and just enjoy the chat that I have here with writer-director Sophie Hyde and the stars of her film, Jimper, at the Adelaide Film Festival from October 2025.
So, firstly, like, a massive congrats. The movie is unreal. Mm. I had an amazing time at the premiere watching it. Oh, and was it fun to hear Adelaideans loving them, like, the piss being taken out of Adelaide? Was that the first experience you had of that? Because I feel like the audience, I miss lines, because like there was a joke, there'd be a little jab for Adelaide, and people go, ha ha ha!
Adelaide loves Adelaide, just to be mentioned. So it's like, we can be joking, we can be praising. We're like, Adelaide, that's us! Like,
no one ever says our name on film.
Exactly. Yeah. I actually wasn't watching.
No, but it's not the first time, because you made a TV show with Kate and I in it called Fucking Adelaide.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. But I think there's a special thing that happens in Australia when Adelaide's mentioned. Everyone has their own idea about it, you know?
Yes.
So, what was beautiful the other night, though, was like how warm it was, how it was like old friends, it was family, it was so many of the crew, lots of our cast, like... It was kind of incredible to just be there and be like, oh, this is for us all to sort of celebrate the movie.
Yeah, it was like a big extended family screening in some ways, a hometown screening. Yeah, it was pretty magic.
It had that good vibe, and you guys have obviously had to just go on the road with it before it comes home, so like trying to get the internationals. And I was sitting with another critic, and we were just so proud of it, so you should definitely be. But I wanted to ask also, who came up with the idea about the best... turn your phone off ad that I've ever seen? I'm like, if I open a cinema, I'm taking that. That's so good.
That ad was so fun to shoot.
Yes.
It was our last day of our Adelaide shoot, and it was just Olivia and I and like a very, very small crew on a train to border town.
Yeah.
And you just kind of turned to us. We finished our shooting like 2 hours out of border town, and you were like, why don't we just shoot something fun?
I had had this idea that we should do it. It was because Taika had done something on one of his films, and we'd seen it, where it was Hunt for the Wilder People. They did a turn off your phone thing. And I always thought it was great, but, you know, we joke about doing it. And I mentioned it to Olivia. I was like, we should do this thing once. And then we just hadn't planned anything. And we just set the camera up, and she just went for it. She just did that. Like, she's amazing. She's such a comic genius. Yeah, she's like, and I'm going to get up, and I'm going to do this. And she interacts with the camera so perfectly. It was like one take.
And it was quite funny sitting next to her, because I sort of kind of didn't know what was happening. I was like, is this for real? Is she talking to the crew? Is she talking to the camera? What's, you know, what's the vibe here?
The crew's all just trying not to laugh the whole time. Yeah.
But you also do whatever Olivia tells you to do. So she's just got away. We go, absolutely. I've wanted to do that my whole life.
That would be a dream.
Because since I was born, I've wanted to do that for myself and for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I didn't know that until now.
Yeah, I didn't know it until
thank
now.
You, thank you, Ms.
Yeah.
I was also just wondering, was there one where she dropped the C-bomb? Because I feel like if there was one, can you C's turn your phone off? Whoever's phone. Which C has a phone out there? I was wondering if that existed, because she is very fond of that word. And if so, I promise you the day I open a cinema, I'll pay you much money to have that to open every screening at that theatre.
She didn't. She's like conscious of how much she loves that word, but she's also conscious of not using it too much.
Yeah.
I mean, she's like, it's true. She would just like, what? She would swear, she would fart,
100%.
You know, everywhere, everywhere, if she could.
Yeah, that was part of the bonding.
Yeah.
If she could, she does.
Pull my finger, fall in love.
Yeah. Pull my finger, fall in love. Thank you.
Yeah, she was probably exercising a lot of self-restraint. Yeah, I think.
The whole film, she's tremendously, I mean, yourself too, Dan, this like, this tremendous restraint, and all your character Francis as well, is like everyone's keeping things so interior, and Olivia is used if you've watched so much of her stuff, you can see her just like people love her completely going off the rails, but you kept her so internal. And what was that like working with her, and why do you think that she was attracted to doing that, like flexing those muscles she doesn't usually get to do?
I mean, I think Olivia really likes to be part of a team and working on something. Like, she's a real actor's actor. Like, she's like, I want to turn up to work and be with the people I work with and do the thing we're doing. And that's really, it doesn't always feel like that with people that have become sort of stars in a way. And she never ever makes you feel like that's what she's doing. So for her, she's like, she rocks up, she enjoys a script, she feels a lot of feelings for the script. She doesn't overthink it. She just goes, okay, I know I feel these feelings. Let's come in, and maybe likes to distract herself quite a lot so she doesn't feel too much before you run, you know? And so in terms of restraint, she would be like, it's only the sad stuff. She would be like, okay, you don't actually want me to cry the whole time, do you? So like, let's just not talk for a second, or like, let's we need to go and do something else, so that you know, she could, and she'd be like, we'd talk about it, like, we should get your take on you first in this one, whereas often she'd want to take later in the running order kind of thing. But on anything that was kind of more emotional, so that she wasn't already a mess, we would do it really early. So she knows herself really
her
well.
Emotion is so close to the surface, and so I actually think the restraint and the interior world of the character, that thing that you're talking about, was not difficult for her, but we were having to be strategic about it. Actually, all of us, I think, because you look at Olivia in a take and you get this big burst of emotion. She has that effect on you. And so there were a couple of days where she and I had a conversation at breakfast of like, okay, we will not be making eye contact until you've done your coverage, because we will both be crying, you know, like, it's just not, you can't do it.
It was kind of part of the challenge though, wasn't it? To be like, she would say, like, how is this character not just in tears? In the scene where Kate's telling the story about the past, and there's the quilt and everything, you know, that scene. And she's like, how do I stand here and not be crying? Do you know? Like, we'd have this conversation. She's like, what would you do? And I was like, you know, the character's very focused on their dad and what their dad needs at that time. So then she would be like, got it. She'd be like, woohoo, I'm thinking about something else. She was just, you know, I think that the watching someone try for a restraint is really interesting to see.
To model it up, yeah.
Yeah, and especially when suddenly there was a character like Kate's character, who comes in with the opposite feeling.
Kate is a sledgehammer in the best possible way in this movie. It's like you're seeing a lot of people, Dan too, like everyone's really trying to maintain focus and understanding and appreciation of this. And then you hear, and then Kate comes in and it's like, bang! And you're like, oh, I love this. I love what this is. I love what this ingredient is going to do to the rest of these people in the room.
She doesn't subscribe to the same kind of rules as the rest of the family and probably finds it kind of deeply infuriating and tedious to come up against, because it's just like, get to the solution. You got to get to the solution. So you talk about it. So you kind of lay it all out.
Like, well, how do you understand each other?
Put your foot around all this stuff, ask for what you need and then talk about it.
Yeah.
The biggest compliment I can give you, Kate, on your performance is there's another huge movie this year, one battle after another, where Leonardo DiCaprio is arguing with someone on the phone because he's forgotten a password, which is the most deeply relatable thing. The second most deeply relatable thing is you saying, these eggs are shit. I want you to tell the kitchen. I don't want any more, but I just want you to know how shit this meal is, and I want them to know. And I was like, I was nearly in tears. I was bottling up like a really like uncontrollable laughter at that energy. It was fantastic.
I mean, I get compared to DiCaprio a lot.
Yeah.
I
know. So, it's a common comparison.
It's common.
Yeah.
The most relatable.
Yeah. I know. I think, I mean, I'm not particularly like that. And so being able to play that is so, I think I probably lean more into restraint. But I am enjoying, as I get older, just like laying your stuff on the table a little bit more. So it was quite, I mean, when we shot that, I laid up a little heavy on the table. It was that day we kind of like, that we were all being asked to restrain ourselves. I was just starting at a different point. It was quite embarrassing. She went real hard in what felt like a very public forum. And so it was like, that's great. Now or you could pull it back. So, you know, I mean, it's like, I think we were all doing the same thing, just had different starting points.
So beautiful. I think you're amazing. I was like, it was heavenly for me to watch the whole team, the whole cast in that particular scene, but Kate and Olivia, such different kinds of actors, like each other so much, but just be so great opposite. You know, the tension of that scene is,
I have to say, a masterclass in acting to just sit between Kate Box and Olivia Colman and just sort of, I have no lines, just to sit there and watch. And really, genuinely, like, me and Frances are so one and the same in that scene, just like, wow. tennis match between the two people either side. Mm. Just like taking it in. A little bit intimidating, but we got through.
You are everyone in the audience awed at that moment. Like, oh shit, what do I say?
Oh, my,
I wish I could just be invisible right now and disappear.
Yeah.
So good. I have to ask, Sophie, because your movies are so much about time. I know that's what really drew 52 Tuesdays drew you to this project, Dan. You were talking about that. And I think Jimper has this amazing instinctive flicker between the time that you're set in and memory and the past. And I was just wondering, like, it was kind of in the best possible way, like, it was really impactful to me. And then I've since watching it, I've kind of tried to unpack it. I'm like, but how can you explain sort of your process of like, how instinctive is that, like, bouncing between? Because I think the editing patterns of this movie make it so impactful, like going back and forth to these different moments or flashing forward to things. And so how planned out was that for you in this movie? Because that, I feel like, is one of the things that's like its secret sauce. It's like not just what you're seeing in any given moment, but it's when you unpredictably flash back to that beautiful quilt scene, or you flash back to, you know, Jimper dancing when he's a young man, and then back to John. It's like, can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's a really hard thing to like get right, and actually in this film, or to sort of discover. I always really wanted to feel the characters at different times, and particularly this idea that there are characters in the film that have this whole other life that you want to hint at, but you aren't going to go into. That's not going to be your main sort of event. So for me, that sort of texture was always really important. And we were blending it with this story that Hannah and Frances are telling about their family. And so we were using it in multiple ways, which is quite unusual. In a film, you're a bit more rules-driven usually with something like that. Like, this is what the flashbacks mean. And in ours, we were trying to weave them together in different ways so they feel like glimpses.
I often thought of them as like, we're sitting here right now, and as you're talking about Dan and 52 Tuesdays, I'm remembering that, oh, Dan and I had a, we just had an email back and forth for years where we would just be like, saw your movie, really liked it, but never met each other. Yeah. And like, we just kept having that. So even as we're here, I'm having that experience.
Yeah.
So I was trying to think of that when we were making the film. It's like, when I look at Kate, I think about living with her in a house when we were in our 20s, or meeting her and she was wearing a tie when we were at, you know, like youth theatre.
Mm.
I thought she was fucking cool.
You know? big Diane Keaton energy rolling in with a tie. Hell yeah.
You know, like, you have that experience as a human. It's just that on film, we like, we want to feel really secure. And as a filmmaker, you want the audience to feel safe, but you also want to throw things in that don't feel like we're used to seeing it, or it's convention that we're accustomed to. But it actually was a very, there was a lot of reasons to remove that over the time. It was a big expense on our project. You know, I think all of the team really shone in those moments. Like, the production designer was just incredible at creating all of that.
It was such an undertaking. I mean, we shot 70 flashbacks in 5 days. Like,
yeah. It
was such a, you know, we cast this whole young ensemble of younger characters.
Rehearsed with them.
Yeah, and it felt...
And what you revealed at the Adelaide Film Fest premiere, that you showed some of them their future selves, which I think is an immense pressure.
Yes,
I'm so glad you guys asked
that
at the premiere.
Yes.
Having to watch John Lithgow and be like, okay, be Lithgow.
Yeah,
it's like,
emulate
cool.
That. Yeah.
Thanks.
But luckily we had rehearsals, so we didn't just go like, here's the scene, do it, which is often what people get. You know, we were building a whole character and like expanding the character in those moments.
Mm.
But I will say, like, even our cuts of the film, even then we were like, this just isn't quite getting there. Like, we couldn't find our rhythm with that.
Yes.
And I feel like eventually we did, but it did take a lot of work. And now I feel like it's part of the movie. It's such a texture.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm. It feels so integral to the movie. And I think to what we're trying to communicate in the film, which is about intergenerational stories within the queer community, and how do you show that without showing the past, the future, the present? How do you not have that? How do you build such an interesting relationship with time? I think it always felt like we had to keep it in some way.
I think that's what's great about Ord and great about the film is, like, there is a massive collision within the queer community because of, like, the, you call them like the pioneers, those people on the front lines of like fighting for rights and then going through the AIDS crisis, and there's a massive sense of like hostility and battle scars. You know, they've been at this for such a long time, and I feel like that connection really fed Frances in a way, because you're looking at Frances and sometimes expecting her to be more hostile or more combative, and you're so centered on it in those moments. And it's like the flashbacks around it make it kind of go like, okay, I'm orienting myself along a timeline right now. I'm not just thinking of myself as an individual. I think that's a real... Those echoes are what makes the movie, I think.
Yeah, I think for Frances, like, their connection with their grandpa, Jim, but also with his world and this, you know, this notion of, like, standing on the shoulders of giants. And then, like, but actually, I think particularly for young Australian queer people, who are the giants? Do you know, who are your specific giants? Like, who are our pioneers here? Who are the people who fought for your rights now? And it doesn't mean like kind of a sort of passive sort of like bowing down to those people either. Like, I think that our communities have to continue to move forward, especially with the kind of vitriol that we're seeing pushed out against trans people now. It's actually on all of us to bring our elders along with us for that and work together and surpass these moments where the language gets in our way or our generational differences get in our way, and sort of connect over what's really underneath it all, which is our shared experiences. And I think, you know, that's what Frances is trying to do, maybe unsuccessfully throughout the film, and it's what we're trying to do in making it.
And have a robust conversation about it, which is interesting in our film, with characters who are like trying to be kind of polite with each other or kind to each other or something as well, you know, that sometimes you do need to push things out. And the beauty of a character like Jim is, as inappropriate and rude as he can be, he also is trying to provoke a conversation and sort of get things out, you know, onto the surface. But there's also this other thing that happens, which is that the AIDS crisis was so massive and so devastating, do you know?
Yeah.
That we kind of have this feeling that they're the only people who've been through the war. you know, in the queer community.
Yes.
And actually everyone has in the queer community because of that. And for me, like, the resonance between Jim and Francis, for instance, or my dad and Ord, is that anyone that's queer and decides or doesn't have a choice about being really public and really open about who they are, they feel the battle scars all the time because they're being abused, attacked, like treated badly, you know. And a lot of people can kind of step back and be more invisible, which has its own challenges, I think. But to me, like, it's really important that we don't forget that there are young people coming up who are having that same feeling of fear and vitriol that Ord was talking about, you know, that it's not just this horrible kind of moment in the past that happened, and it's changed.
It's ongoing, right? Like,
it's ongoing.
Even just within AIDS, like, you know, the US just removed funding to a huge program for HIV combatants in Africa. So, you know, we're like, we are in the midst of a pandemic in our community. We're in the midst of great tragedy, but also great celebration. And so, you know, being able to hold all of that, I don't think any of us are doing it well. We're perfect. But I think we're all trying, and it's actually, it's really about being in community and having these conversations and not being afraid of stepping on each other's toes, because we're kind of aware that we're looking to something greater than ourselves.
Mm. But I think one of the beauties in kind of seeing, you know, shooting it, but then also seeing Jim Farr, is that thing that the flashbacks do, I suppose, where it's really hard to hold on to a whole person, you know, your dad or your grandfather or that person through who they are in front of you at that time, and you can hold on to certain ideas of them and certain actions that are in front of them. But if you can also have an image in your body of how they moved in a room, you know, when the music was on, like, or how, you know, that this kind of an understanding of them in a more kind of sensual, intimate way, you kind of have a grant, like a I don't know, the empathy that you have for a human grows when you see these tiny vulnerable moments of them as a child, or them kind of
which is what films
dancing
for.
With their hands in the air, or, you know, and to be able, the flashbacks do that so beautifully in this, and that you go, oh, I so quickly feel you, like, not just kind of know who you are in this moment, but I feel you, and therefore I can hold you, and therefore I can I can understand you and empathize with you in a greater way.
I think for an audience there's a universality to it, so it doesn't matter how you come to it, you have your own histories with your own people, and that evokes, without words telling you what's happening, you're seeing an image across the screen and it viscerally hits you. And that's the beauty, in that you don't get to meet all of these characters fully fleshed, but you get to see little glimpses, which tells you so much more about them, rather than a monologue or a conversation. And, you know, characters like Richard's character, you get little glimpses into their character, or the aunties.
Yes.
The aunties. Do you know, like, and all of that stuff, I get goosebumps. So, and I just think that is such a clever way and straight to the heart in what the film, I may be incorrect, but the film for me is opening up everybody to the possibility of loving everybody.
Yes.
And it's inclusive. And people fight, and they have different opinions, and they hold dear to those opinions that they've had for so many years, and they're challenged by people with different ideas and different sense of selves, but there's so much love in the film.
Yeah.
And even when it's hard or sad or traumatic or hurtful, I kind of get goosebumps. But it's just like that, the flashbacks really feed that without being intellectually told what to feel.
Yes.
You know, you just get taken off on a journey with it.
And without those words that corrupt us, like we say, they're an activist. But actually you see that feeling, you're like, oh, they're a young man fighting for something. And if you do a thing like we sometimes do, like you look at each other or people in the room and you're like, imagine them as a kid, like little Dan Henschel, little Dan. And you're just like, oh God, I love you even more.
This moment, because there's a project running alongside Jim Parr called Queerest Parts of Ourselves, and you can, you know, bring in photos or stories. And I was just looking at some photos to send in. And I've seen this photo a gazillion times. It's been in my family photo album, but there was just this photo of me and my mum dancing when I was maybe 4. And I'd never looked at it in any other way other than, oh, it's me and my mum. And there was just something in that, I think, after, you know, being in this film and seeing this film, where I just went, oh, that is the queerest part of myself. It's just this completely different look back on that. And I think that you know, a few people that I've talked to after the screening the other night, you know, just saying the reflection on the kind of intimacy within their own family has been something that has, has been really potent coming out of people's experience of this film. And I was like, and just for myself, reflecting on that moment in a very different way, just going, what was that little gay thing that was that?
Yeah. It's so beautiful though, isn't it, Kate? Because it's like, I think there's that moment where you recognize yourself as a kid. I think particularly as a queer person, where you, I think so often our narratives about queerness and about coming out are these narratives of leaving our biological families or having to have distance or estrangement, or that our queerness is somehow in opposition to. When actually, so often, not only is it born and bred in those biological families, but also, you know, I think what the film does for it so beautifully is kind of put forward this model of, how about just an abundance of family? Like, what if you have your biological family and a chosen family and they know each other? And there's challenge to that, right? But, like, also then you get to see these beautiful moments of you dancing with your mum, and you go, like, that is the queerest part of it, right? Because it all can exist in the same room.
We've been talking about provocative stuff like Mr. John Lithgow. And I want to thank you in advance. I'm just putting it out there. There's going to be some kids who are watching a HBO Max Harry Potter series in a couple of years. We're going to come back to Jinpa, and see John Lithgow in a way they've never imagined. And Dumbledore is truly going to get the queer reading that he needs and happened in this movie. So thank you. Can I ask, how is the cycle of, is it get Olivia, get John? Is it get John, get Olivia? How did John come into this project? Get Kate, get Dan.
I mean,
how do I get Henschel into this?
I mean, what you bring up is a very controversial thing for all of us, that, that John's gone and done, is going and doing the Harry Potter thing, and J.K. Rowling is like at the forefront of like attacking trans people. It's been very difficult, I think, for all of us. And we all have our strong feelings about that. Obviously, we worked with John before that, so it's a mixed lot of feelings that we have.
And to be clear, on an interpersonal level, he's so beautiful and loving.
Yeah, that's right.
And I kind of love your read on it as well, of like, you know, I think what really
play the long game.
I have so many feelings about it, but you know, but it's kind of nice to reframe it in that way. Of like, there will be kids who get access to, whether it's this film or it's, you know, The World According to Garp, or, you know, another John Lithgow project that is, you know, Iris Sachs film, like Love is Strange. Like, you know, the wealth of things that an actor can bring to the world, and that connection to film through whatever it is can bring, is quite a beautiful thing
and,
to recognize.
And by the way, I mean, that is would be John's position too, is like, I'm going to, I can be there and be an ally to this community as well. And, you know, that's, everyone has different opinions about this, you know, but it also is like, for us working with him, he was a beautiful,
I'm just hoping that it picks it up with my audio. Oh, I'm sorry that I touched a chord. I'm sorry.
It's a really important thing to speak about because John was a really beautiful human to work with on this project, and is a beautiful person. And I do think there is something about being able to speak outside of and also within our queer communities. And so that's something that, you know, continues to be a challenge, because some people are really angry about it and they're like, I don't want to see the film, you know, because you have him in it. And then I'm sort of like, well, the film also is a queer film from a queer from queer filmmakers with a trans non-binary lead. Do you know, like, so you kind of want everyone to kind of come at it for different reasons. But to go back to your question, it was Olivia first. Like, Olivia is... We had kind of been had the script around for a little while, and we really wanted Olivia and found it hard to get to her. And so it had been put aside for a while. And then when I finally got it to her, everything moved really fast. Like, she read it, and in like a week we were on a Zoom, and then she said yes, and then we had to finance it really, really fast around her availability. And John came in actually quite a lot later, during like our pre-production period, because we always thought we needed to kind of certainly have that character of Hannah, Olivia's character, cast to be able to work out how it was all going to work.
But I mean, talk about an actor who is such an ally to the queer and trans community. Olivia Colman is just, I mean, yeah. She's such a wonderful person to work with on an actor's level, but also she just like continuously chooses these projects where she gets the champion. I mean, whether it's Heartstopper, whether it's this, like she, you know, she's alongside us, I think, which is such a beautiful thing. Mm. You know, making fart jokes the whole time. So it's perfect. Still.
So much love, so many farts.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Beautiful.
That's the title.
That's
the
title.
Yeah.
Complicated farting.
The queerest farts of us.
You said that.
I did.
You
did
it. You did it. There is a needle drop in this movie by the Japanese House, which
it's so good.
Is one of the best needle drops of all time in any movie that I've seen that I can remember.
Yeah.
And it just, that whole sequence, that montage, after a movie that is elliptical and like impulsive, like memory and distracted, you know, taking us back and seeing the whole people, that is a piece of montage that is so stunning. I just want to congratulate you on it because it was amazing. Was that track something that you want, like you wanted, did that hit you? Because I'm a bit of a Japanese House person too, so I'd heard as soon as it came, I'm like, oh shit, this is so good.
I'm amazed that you recognize it actually, because that so that particular EP of Japanese House is like something that I've had on my phone, and I have no.
Sorry, I just want to point out these guys are like, I don't know what.
No,
you're
I do. I actually do.
I don't know what they're talking about.
I
love these two at the end chipping in.
Someone that we all love mentioned it to me that they may have introduced it to you.
Oh,
Mr. McLean.
Oh.
No,
that's Kishibashi.
Gotcha. I don't know what you're talking about.
So it's three, because a lot of people think the needle drop moment is the boy genius at the end. They're like, boom, boy genius.
Turns out he just got heaps of needle drops.
Sick needle drops.
Kishibashi,
which is that one.
Francis sex scene.
Yeah, which is...
The one we're talking about is when you take Francis to drop them off of the queer kids. You know that song?
That, your best moment of the film too, isn't it?
Yeah, gorgeous.
Amazing.
Look, that's that EP. It's a four-track EP, and I have no music on my phone because I'm shit at that. And I've had that on my phone forever, for years, and I listen to it all the time.
I just want to say, it's not only does Mum have it on her phone, whenever we get into the car,
it's the
phone
track
autoplays the one thing she has on her phone. So this song has just been in the background of our lives for
so long.
Yeah,
I love it.
Long.
The whole album, and I've used one of the tracks before in something else. But when we were in the middle of the edit, I was like, oh, I just suddenly had this feeling that the song should go in. We put it in, it's like such a long piece.
Yeah.
And I didn't think we'd be able to get it. But or like it would be too expensive for us to use such a lot of a song. But the music supervisor was great and worked with all of the musicians really closely. So I love that too.
Yeah
it's got the most amazing sound.
Yeah.
When do we get to the soundtrack? When does it drop?
Yeah, people were asking that a lot the other night. There's actually only like 4 or 5 songs in the whole thing because the rest of it's
same
like
your phone.
Song
is
yeah, I think they want to release Ord and Brendan's cover of the Moona song from the end.
That'd
be good.
At least hell yeah, get that up on Spotify, Apple, whatever you got to do it.
Yeah.
I think I'm out of time, but I just wanted to say it's so awesome talking to you guys. It's been
so
fun.
Thank you
so
much.
So fun. Congratulations
on
the flick. It's been amazing. And it was...
Thanks.
This conversation was super fun.
Yeah, you really kicked us out.
We
were
just
really
went there, didn't we?
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.